What the Trump plan did is it showed Netanyahu's true face. It says to Palestinians who are living in the occupied territories, we don't want you. But the plan is also saying to Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, you also don't belong. And so we have the right to get rid of you.
I'm Henriya Chakar, here with Amjad Iraqi, and you're listening to the 972 podcast. Every episode, we explore issues and stories that other media outlets tend to ignore. Guess who's back?
What?
He's back again.
What are you talking about?
Bibi's back. Tell a friend.
My God. Thank you. Thank you for bringing Eminem to this podcast, Henriette. Really appreciate it. But yeah, you're right. Israelis went to the polls for a third time in a year. And a few hours after they closed, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, or Bibi as Israelis call him, already declared victory.
The thing is, not much has changed from the previous two rounds. Neither Likud nor Blue and White, the two biggest parties, have secured the parliamentary majority needed to form a government. And one of the critical players that can decide this contest is the Joint List, the Palestinian-led slate, which came in third with a historic 15 seats.
So a few days before the election, I actually spoke with Diana Butu, who is a Palestinian human rights lawyer and analyst and a former advisor to the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO. She correctly predicted that Palestinian citizens of Israel, who make up a fifth of the state's population, would vote in even greater numbers this time around as a response to the growing racism in Israeli politics.
Did she also think that President Donald Trump's deal of the century was on their minds?
Yes, very much so. She told me how the plan has really alarmed Palestinians by essentially determining their fate without their participation. But before we got to that, I was actually curious to hear her thoughts about the broader Palestinian reaction to the deal, particularly at the level of the political leadership. And here's what she had to say. Diana Butu, a very, very warm welcome to the 972 podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's kick off. It's been exactly a month since U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called deal of the century was announced at the White House.
Forging peace between Israelis and Palestinians may be the most difficult challenge of all. All prior administrations from President Lyndon Johnson have tried and bitterly failed. But I was not elected to do small things or shy away from big problems.
What were your main takeaways when you saw the plan and when you read the plan? And 1 month on, has there been anything new or different in the way that you're understanding that plan?
It's a great question. My first reaction was arrogance, that this was a lot of arrogance, a lot of men sitting around in a room discussing the fate of another people, much like you would see a group of men discussing the rights of women to their own reproductive rights. And so it was a combination of arrogance as well as seeing this as being a Jewish-only conversation with Palestinians thrown out of the conversation, not just excluded, but deliberately thrown out of the conversation. And then a lot of fantasy. A lot of the ideas that were presented were the ideas of, you know, of a lot of Israeli fantasies, that somehow Palestinians are going to agree to their own subjugation, that somehow Palestinians are going to agree to be living in cantons, that somehow Palestinians are going to not demand their right of return, not demand Jerusalem, etc. So there was a mix of feeling that this was arrogance, a mix of feeling that this was a sense that somebody else was deciding our own fate, and that it was really an internal Jewish question / fantasy.
Mm. I want to continue off of that, actually, because there seems to have been quite a few mixed feelings among Palestinians in response to the deal. I don't think many people were surprised of how bad it was going to be, but we get the sense sometimes that some seemed unsure of whether to dismiss this as sort of like a charade of some type or whether they should be shocked by its contents. What were your impressions of the Palestinian public's reactions to the plan itself?
I want to step back for a second in terms of the content. I'm not somebody who's going to dismiss it. And the reason I don't think we should be dismissing it is because I've seen how this has progressed over the years. Look, in terms of the content, in terms of the idea of taking all of the Israeli settlements, in terms of the issue of Jerusalem, in terms of getting rid of the right of return, in terms of making sure that Palestinians live subjugated, all of that was not new. But there were some new elements in this plan that I think are very alarming. And the first alarming element is the fact that it's building off of the viewpoint of Meir Kahane, where he was talking decades ago of getting rid of Palestinians, of ethnically cleansing Palestinians who are citizens of Israel. And so you see for the first time in this plan, the idea or the attempt to try to get rid of 350,000 Palestinians who are citizens of the state of Israel, and with the future of the remaining Palestinian citizens of Israel completely unknown. So that was one element of this plan that was definitely alarming. The other part of the plan that was definitely alarming was the fact that there was this idea that somehow they think that they can continue to subjugate people for eternity, and that we are going to go along with that. So it's those two elements combined that for me were, I don't want to say shocking, but we should be shocked by them. And that we really have to pay attention to, because having been in the negotiations in the past, these ideas don't come from nowhere. And not just they don't come from nowhere, they're going to build on these ideas. So for example, when I was talking about the getting rid of Palestinian citizens of Israel, that was an issue that was never raised in the negotiations in the past. There was at one negotiation session an attempt by one individual to talk about this, and then it was very quickly dismissed. But the fact that this is now playing a role and being articulated in not just by the Israelis, but by the United States, that's the part that we really should be concerned about, because that is going to be the direction of future Israeli governments. So too, annexation is going to be the direction of future Israeli governments. In terms of the reaction, I think that the reaction was mixed. There was, on the one hand, a reaction that is dismissing it outright because people view Donald Trump as a joke. They view that this was somehow done for to secure Netanyahu's election victory. The fact that it wasn't translated into Arabic or into Hebrew is indicative of this. But I also think that we should be we shouldn't just be taking it as though it's a joke, and should be really pushing back and re-strategizing and thinking about what does this step mean for us. And this is why I think that what the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, has been bad at doing is that they've just simply been talking about dismissing it, getting world condemnation around it, but not doing anything that is positive. So, for example, they haven't been pushing for Israeli accountability. They haven't been signing on to a global BDS call. They haven't been pushing world states to hold Israel accountable, place sanctions on Israel. It's just been a question of let's go back to the same old of either pushing for state recognition, and that doesn't give us anything, or to ask for a condemnation of the plan. And neither one of those is going to secure Palestinian freedom.
So having said that, and seeing that the PA is basically going back to the same old tactics, not offering anything new, do you know if there's anything going on behind the scenes, or are there discussions or debates in the PLO or the PA about how to move forward? There's no kind of, you're not seeing any kind of new strategic thinking on this front, or
no.
Even the sense of that time's kind of closing in on them, on what they can do or what they can't do?
Time is definitely closing in on them. And this is a leadership that has been living off of waiting for one presidency to end and another to begin. And they've been doing this for at least two decades. That let's wait for President Clinton to exit the scene, President Bush will somehow be better for us. Wait for President Bush to exit the scene. President Obama will be better for us. Wait for President Obama to exit the scene. Trump is definitely going to be better for us. And here we are with Trump, the worst of the ones that I've listed. And there's still the sense that they're going to wait for President Trump to exit the scene and somebody else to come forward to be the, lack of a better term, to be the savior. You know, I understand that to live under military occupation, I get it, I live under occupation, so do you, means that you're not the master of your own destiny. You don't get to choose your own future. I understand that. But it also doesn't mean that you just passively sit back. And that's unfortunately what the PA has done for quite some time, is they've passively sat back waiting for world opinion to somehow change vis-a-vis Israel. And rather than it changing to their, because of their actions, it's changed mostly because of Israeli racism more than anything else. And even on that front, it's not changing in such a way that it's going to be a fundamental shift in the way that countries around the world approach Israel. It's mostly a shift in the way that individuals view Israel.
If the PA itself is not changing anything, if we step back a little bit, how are you seeing the deal play out in terms of the dynamics, let's say, between Fatah and Hamas right now, and also between the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian public? What debates, discussions, tensions, or kind of renewed communications, if any, are unfolding from the deal, if at all? What's happening within the community to say, like, what can we do to change, and what can be taken to address this plan head on?
It's sad to say, but Mahmoud Abbas is using this as an opportunity to do nothing. So I'll back up. Over the course of the past 15 years since Mahmoud Abbas, the current president of the Palestinian Authority, since he's been in office, he's used like one of four techniques to try to gain legitimacy or get support. So one of them is he'll occasionally call for the dissolving of the Palestinian Authority. The second one is he'll occasionally call for the ending of security collaboration. I don't call it cooperation or coordination. It's actually collaboration with the Israeli army. A third technique is he sometimes calls for elections. And then a fourth technique is he often calls for reconciliation. So it's one of those four that he always, you know, pulls a lever at any moment in when there's a crisis. And so just before the announcement of the Trump-Netanyahu plan a month ago, His latest card that he was pulling was to hold elections. And now that we have this Trump plan, Trump-Netanyahu plan, on the table, he's put that card back and instead is saying, I don't really need to do anything. At most, he'll claim that he's going to end security collaboration. He's certainly not speaking about dissolving the PA any longer. He's not talking about reconciliation. He's definitely not talking about resignation, which is something that he had done in the past. So instead, what he's doing is focused on the plan as a means of just continuing the process of doing nothing. Now, I want to be clear in saying that the process of doing nothing has tremendous consequences for Palestinians living in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, particularly in the West Bank. This is a president who has gone down the path of authoritarianism. He has made sure that that there is no dissent within the Palestinian Authority. He ended up closing down the parliament to make sure that there is no successor to him when he eventually dies. He has gone after and made sure that the judiciary is filled with people who are loyal to him. He's gone after Palestinian media and tried to crush Palestinian media dissent. And he's even gone after civil society organizations. So his method of doing nothing is to do nothing on an international stage when it comes to securing Palestinian freedom. But he is doing a whole lot of something in terms of making sure that Palestinians are repressed inside the West Bank.
And are you seeing a pushback on that from Palestinian civil society, on the Palestinian grassroots, both you know, on the ground in the occupied territories inside Israel as well, and also Palestinians abroad and their allies. Are you seeing this some attempts to try to circumvent this roadblock that's being created by the leadership?
Yes, I do. There are some people who are really organizing and trying to move around the Palestinian authorities. So everything from people who've been calling for the PA's dissolution to people who are in civil society who are actively pushing back against a lot of these repressive measures that we see within the PA, to the people who are in Gaza who are putting their bodies on the line through the Great Return March. And you can see this in the public opinion polls. Look, without there being a single Palestinian political party or movement that is advocating one state, we are already seeing that the numbers of Palestinians who support one state is on the rise. The last poll by Khalil Shukaki, which, by the way, only polls Palestinians who are in the occupied territories. It's not polling anybody other than that. We saw that 37% of those who were polled support one state, and that only 39% support two states. And then of those polls, we see that roughly 70% of Palestinians don't trust Mahmoud Abbas, want to see him out of office. And so, you know, the numbers are really stark. The problem is that there isn't just a question of being able to organize. It's that this authority has done its best to try to block attempts to go around it. This organizing is happening despite the extensive repression that is being conducted by the Palestinian Authority against people who believe in a different vision or in a different future for Palestine and for Palestinians.
And if we go the level above, which of course that the Palestinian Authority and even Hamas are operating under the system of the Israeli occupation itself, and we have the Israeli elections coming up in just a few days, and given the month that's passed now since the deal was announced, how have you seen the deal be manifested or influence Israeli political dynamics, the views of the Israeli electorate? Do you think that will have a role to play when Israelis go to the polls?
I do, but not in the way that that Netanyahu thinks that it's going to impact these elections. I think that Netanyahu thought that by unveiling the Trump plan, that he would get a lot of voters, and he would get people who were otherwise voting for blue and white, or otherwise voting for the right wing, to now support him. And instead, that isn't something that we see is happening. The polls are roughly showing that the numbers are the same when it comes to support for Netanyahu before the plan was unveiled and after the plan was unveiled. What it is changing, however, is that it is making Palestinians who are citizens of Israel see exactly what Netanyahu believes and how he thinks. And what the Trump plan did is it showed Netanyahu's true face. It says to Palestinians who are living in the occupied territories, we don't want you. But the plan is also saying to Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, you also don't belong in this state of Israel. And so we have the right to get rid of you, to ethnically cleanse you, to redraw boundaries as though we are pawns in a chess game. And so on that front, it is politicizing Palestinian citizens of Israel to get out, to go vote, as the point of the matter is that he, Netanyahu, doesn't want to see Palestinian voters out to go out and vote. And this is actually having the exact opposite effect. Now, seeing that this is having the exact opposite effect, Netanyahu has now tried to scale back some of the comments. And he's done one of two things. One, he said to Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, no, that part of the Trump plan will never be implemented, which isn't the case at all. It's certainly an indicative of the viewpoint that he and the racist Meir Kahane have. But he's also tried to lure Palestinians to vote for him. We've seen a number of statements from people who are in his cabinet saying how great life is for Palestinians who are citizens of Israel under Netanyahu. So he's been trying to take away trying to get people not to vote or to get them to vote for him. And I think that what we're going to see on this upcoming election is that we are going to see more and more Palestinians going out to vote in order to send the message to Netanyahu that they're really quite tired of his racism.
Now, this brings the question of Benny Gantz, the leader of the Blue and White Party. In the previous election round back in September, the joint list made a rather bold move to essentially recommend Gantz as prime minister. And they made it clear that they had numerous problems with Gantz, but that it was, among the several reasons, it was a strategy to get Benjamin Netanyahu out of power, precisely because of the blatant racism, the extent to which the past decade has produced numerous racist laws and so on and so forth. Now, Gantz himself was also at the White House to essentially see the deal, and Gantz himself approved of the deal. How has the joint list, the representatives of the different united Palestinian political parties in Israel, how have they kind of dealt with both the results of that recommendation back in September and now linking it to how Benny Gantz has now essentially approved the Trump plan, as well as further kind of declarations in support of annexation? How are Palestinian citizens, or how are their leaders navigating what to do in this next round?
I'm not sure that they are, to be honest, Amjad. One thing that I think is clear when the Trump-Netanyahu plan, I like calling it Trump-Netanyahu plan because I do feel that Netanyahu had more than a heavy hand at drafting it. One thing that was clear when this plan came out is that Gantz wasn't going to be the opposition. He isn't going to be somebody who steps back and says, no, this isn't something that that I don't like. In fact, he has applauded the plan. He may not have applauded all parts of the plan. But the fact that we have an Israeli leadership that is openly talking of annexation, and that even the opposition is approving of annexation, shows you just exactly how to the right this Israeli society is. When you have the leader of the opposition also expressing views of a greater Israel, and talking and bragging that it was his idea to begin with. This is Benny Gantz bragging that annexation was his idea to begin with. You can see just how far to the right Israeli society is. And so one thing that I think is interesting in all of this is that the joint list has had to really contend with the decision that they made back in September. And back in September, as you mentioned, this wasn't a unanimous decision, and it certainly wasn't a decision that I think they took lightly. There were three members, three MKs, who decided not to go with the choice of recommending one or the other. You know, as you know, that after every Israeli election, each of the parties is asked between these two candidates who have received the most votes, which do you recommend to be the prime minister? And traditionally, Palestinians have always said, this is not the game that we are playing, because both of them, all of these parties tend to be war criminals. And so it's important to note that there were three members of Knesset who didn't want to go down that path and who made it very clear that they were not going to recommend one over the other. They weren't going to recommend Gantz over Netanyahu. So I think that what's happened now is that the joint list has now had to contend with that decision that they took back in September, and they've made it clear that they won't make that decision again in March. I'm not so sure. I think that they're saying that in order to secure votes. I think that they're saying that in order to get people out to vote. But I don't know if faced with the same situation on March the 2nd, whether they're going to make a recommendation for Gantz over Netanyahu. Because for some of them, they're viewing this as a calculation of being able to get rid of Netanyahu, and he needs to be gotten rid of. Whereas others are saying that we can't go down the path of being the quote-unquote kingmakers inside Israeli politics. It's been interesting to watch the Netanyahu election campaign, because he is obsessed, and I say obsessed because he's absolutely obsessed with Arab voters, and in particular with Ahmed Tibi. His campaign slogan, as I'm sure you know, has been, it's either Bibi, his nickname, or TB. And he's taken out billboards in some of the most expensive billboards in the country in front of the stock exchange with a picture of Gantz and Ahmed TB, and with a caption that reads, "Without Ahmed TB, there is no Gantz government." So feeding into that racism, which is something that he loves to do. As you know, Ahmed TB is a Palestinian member of Knesset. He leads one of the parties that comprises the joint list.
So in addition to the Israeli elections, the deal of the century is also hanging over the elections in November in the United States. And Israel-Palestine has actually been now a huge topic of conversation within the Democratic Party, with presidential candidates like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. And now there's also been this new saga around AIPAC, where almost all the Democratic candidates have essentially declined to participate at the AIPAC annual conference, AIPAC being one of the major Israel lobby groups, in Washington. We've seen that here on the ground in the Israeli political scene that there's not a lot of divide between the major parties in regards how to approach the deal of the century, how to approach annexation in the future, and so on and so forth. And also on the Palestinian front on the ground, that things appear static for the time being. How does the United States elections play into this? Are you seeing a space and opportunities where this might evolve, that this might change? What will the November elections mean for the deal of the century? What will it mean for Israelis and Palestinians in the future?
That's a great question. I'm not so sure that it means a lot, to be honest. The terrifying thing about this Trump-Netanyahu plan is not just the contents of the plan, but the fact that it's being implemented on the ground as we speak. For example, moving the embassy, the U.S. embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem was condemned by the international community. Very few countries have followed suit. I think there's only been two countries that have followed suit. It wasn't this groundbreaking event that President Trump was thinking it was going to be. That being said, there isn't yet a Democratic candidate who has expressed that he or she will move the embassy back. So this is a fact on the ground that has been created that isn't going to be uncreated. Similarly, when it comes to annexation, we already see that Israel has annexed large parts of the West Bank. The only difference now is that the right wing wants a declaration that that the Palestinians lost. They want something that is in law that it's been annexed, not in fact as it already has been annexed. And so they're looking for a declaration that Palestinians have been defeated. That being said, you know, we haven't seen any Democratic candidates that come back and say, we're going to undo this. We're going to push back. We're going to make sure that Israel pulls out of settlements. It's not something that's happening. What I think, though, is positive is that we're seeing signs that the Democratic candidates are recognizing just how racist AIPAC is and just how racist Netanyahu is. And this is not the result, by the way, of just like magic fairies. This is the result of people who've been working on the ground throughout the world, and in particular in the occupied territories and in 48, to make sure that Netanyahu's racism is highlighted and to make sure that AIPAC's racism is highlighted. In the past, it used to be that going to the AIPAC conference was not only something like, you know, punching a card that you had to do, but it was really a way of garnering support from voters for upcoming elections. And now they're beginning to see, these candidates, Democratic candidates, are beginning to see that it's actually a liability, it's not an asset. So while I don't think that anything's going to change, that these Democratic candidates are going to do anything to change the situation on the ground for us here, I don't see that they're going to move the embassy back. I don't see that they're going to stop the settlement activity. I don't see that they're going to push back against annexation. They are recognizing that support for Israel has become a liability, and that's a good first step.
And do you see this also playing out in terms of the debate around military funding to Israel, that even if it's not necessarily going to be huge policy shifts regarding the embassy, regarding annexation, but do you see the possibility of conditioning these funds as a potential even small game changer?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The line used to be, the AIPAC line used to be that there is no daylight between American policy and AIPAC. There is no daylight between America and Israel. There's daylight now. It's small, but it's starting to, we see a little bit happening, and it is going to grow. It is going to grow.
Diana Butu, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by myself and Henriette Shaka, who also edited the episode. If you like what you hear, make sure to hit subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you catch all the latest episodes in your feed. It also helps us a ton if you leave a review. This way other people can also find us. Oh, and this episode was not sponsored by M&M.